Thomas Sowell hit the nail on the head in this respect. We're ignoring the voluntary sorting in a sense. It might be better if they dismissed him, if they talked about him and said, listen to this kook. Right, right. At least you're arguing his point. They just act as if he doesn't exist. It's like, how can you say that? And then you say, well, is it true? Well, yeah, it's true, but you can't say that, right? If for nothing else, because of what he's accomplished in an era that we're all race crazy, shouldn't we be propping him up for that alone? That's where the people will come after Sowell and say, see, he's insensitive and he doesn't care. Problem with most of the things we're trying to solve is no one wants to talk about the whole story.
Welcome to episode 11 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin. Today, we're going to plunge headfirst into a topic which I have been intentionally avoiding with the podcast so far, the subject of race. There are two reasons I've been avoiding this subject. Number one, I don't personally enjoy talking about race. I find it kind of boring. One of the things I love about Sowell is that race is only a small portion of his scholarship. It's not the main focus. In this regard, he's not a one-trick pony like so many other intellectuals of our time. Sowell writes about economics, political theory, education, knowledge, culture, and so many other topics besides race. And when he does write about race, it's mostly to debunk how others think about it. Here's John McWhorter talking about this aspect of Sowell.
Talk about rare bird. He is a Black academic who quite often has written on non-racial subjects, you know, just an economics textbook, two volumes. He can step completely outside of the race thing and just express himself about just stuff, which is not the usual. And I find it interesting that with Sowell, one reason some people today would find it hard to go with him is that he doesn't write with that tribalist sense. He's trying to be purely objective. And there's nothing in him of, here's what we down here think. Here's what we've been through. It's not seasoned with any of that. He's just trying to have a white lab coat on and look at the facts.
Number two, I find race to be a mostly artificial way to talk about people. And I find today's focus on race to be almost a pathological obsession. For me, it's as if intellectuals were to be totally focused on what sign of the zodiac people are. Oh, he's a Sagittarius. No wonder he's like that. Or, you're quite stubborn for a Taurus, but I can see how the moon you were born under would explain that. I remember when Black Lives Matter got big, I was thinking to myself, oh, great. Now we're going to be stuck talking about race every day for the next 5 years. Unfortunately, I turned out to be right about that. So up until now, I've been focusing mostly on non-race-related aspects of Sowell's work, like minimum wage laws, the role of intellectuals in society, moral crusades, and other general subjects. The one exception might be the debate we hosted about the history of slavery. But according to Sowell, slavery had little to do with race anyway. So why am I talking about race today, you might be wondering. Here's how I came to the idea. I invited Charles Love onto the show, and he graciously agreed to come on. And I got to thinking about what Charles and I could discuss that would be up his alley. Charles had just published a book called Race Crazy, BLM, 1619, and the Progressive Racism Movement. From his book, I got the sense that Charles thinks focusing on race all the time is just as crazy and pathological as I do. The first line of the book's description on the Simon & Schuster website is, quote, "The progressive left has gone race crazy, and they want to take America down the same path of insanity," end quote. Obviously, Charles pulls no punches, and neither does Thomas Sowell, and neither do I, so we're all a good fit. So I picked one of Sowell's books on the subject of race to kick off the discussion, The book is called Discrimination and Disparities, and it was published 4 years ago. I'd like to focus on just one chapter of the book to make this discussion all the more bite-sized and manageable. In the show notes, I put a link to chapter 3 of the book. The chapter is only 25 pages long, and it's called Sorting and Unsorting People. I highly recommend you read the chapter before you listen to the rest of this episode. You know I will be summarizing the chapter in this podcast, but still, there is no substitute for reading the original Sowell text. It's well worth the extra effort. As always, Sowell makes some quite remarkable arguments in that chapter, which are not only paradigm-shifting, but also mind-blowing once you let them sink in. So before I invite Charles Love to join me to discuss Sowell's ideas, here's my summary of Chapter 3 of Discrimination and Disparities. Buckle up. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Sowell names the chapter Sorting and Unsorting People, which is a somewhat unusual way to refer to people. Of all the things we usually do with other people, we don't usually think of sorting and unsorting them. What does he mean by this? Let's hear how Sowell defines the terms himself.
Much empirical evidence suggests that human beings do not interact randomly, nor as frequently or as intensely, with all other human beings as with selected subsets of people like themselves. In short, people sort themselves out, both in where they choose to live and with whom they choose to interact most often and most closely.
So people are sorting themselves into different categories all the time. When they decide who to socialize with, who to go to school or work with, who to marry, and which other people to live around, this is all sorting behavior. Sowell makes the point that this sorting behavior is seldom random and is often quite skewed. According to Sowell, there are two basic types of sorting behavior. Type number one is self-sorting, and type number two is sorting which is imposed upon you by third parties. So you're either sorting yourself or other people are sorting you, in or out. Sowell gives the example of residential sorting. You might decide to move into a certain type of neighborhood, and there are many categories of neighborhoods you can choose from. There are mostly white neighborhoods, as well as mostly Black, Latino, Chinese, Korean, or Armenian neighborhoods. There are upscale neighborhoods, as well as mid and downscale neighborhoods. There are Muslim neighborhoods, Jewish neighborhoods, and Christian neighborhoods. There are even lifestyle neighborhoods. For example, the hippie neighborhood of Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, or the gay neighborhood of the Castro, also in San Francisco. Interestingly, these types of lifestyle neighborhoods simultaneously unsort people by some of the other racial, ethnic, or economic categories. So people typically sort themselves into groups simply by choosing where to live. But there are many examples also of where third parties make these decisions for you and, quote, force you to sort yourself into or out of certain neighborhoods. Government laws, restrictive covenants in real estate deeds, homeowners association veto powers, and even the threat of violence by others can determine where you can live and where you can't. One example of this type of third-party sorting can be found in the history of the Jews, according to Sowell. He points out that Jews in Europe for many centuries were forced to live in ghettos imposed on them by the Christian majorities. The word ghetto itself was an Italian word which originally referred to a part of Venice, which was one of the first forced Jewish neighborhoods in Italy, and was guarded around the clock by Christian watchmen. But getting back to self-sorting, Sowell points out that immigrants usually cluster when they arrive in a new country, oftentimes in ways that are not obvious to outsiders. For example, Italians, while they tend to cluster in Italian neighborhoods, they cluster even more around other Italians from the same region of Italy which they came from. So Italians from Genoa live around other Genoans, while Italians from Sicily live near other Sicilians. The same patterns are seen with Jews from various European countries. Hungarian Jews lived near other Hungarian Jews in different enclaves from where German Jews clustered. What is really interesting about this pattern is that outsiders will most likely not notice the clustering going on and will simply assume that all Italians are living around other Italians without seeing the finer distinctions at play in these groups' self-sorting behavior. In addition, a neighborhood which is clustered into Italian sections, Polish sections, Jewish sections, Greek sections, German sections, etc., might simply be viewed by the naked eye as a so-called white neighborhood, without the need to take into account the extreme self-sorting which is really going on behind the scenes. For this reason, says Sowell, people are much more inclined to see the self-sorting which occurs between whites and blacks as being a more extreme and distinct phenomenon from the type of sorting which is going on between different white communities, while in fact it's the exact same thing happening. Sowell says this:
however striking these patterns may be statistically, they are not patterns that most people are made aware of by seeing them with the naked eye, as is the case with differences between black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods in the United States. As a result, black-white residential separations have been seen and treated as if they were unique, as well as being inconsistent with prevailing background assumptions of equal or random outcomes in the absence of discriminatory impositions.
Sowell points out another interesting fact, that black communities are not simply sorted out from white communities, but also that there is dramatic sorting going on within black communities themselves. Sowell draws upon the work of E. Franklin Frazier to show clear patterns of clustering within black communities, where people are sorted into groups by family structure, behavioral standards, delinquency rates, homeowners versus renters, and even occupational clusters. One example of this was the two distinctly upscale black neighborhoods within Harlem, nicknamed Stryver's Row and Sugar Hill. Apparently, according to Sowell, this type of self-sorting is common in all cultures and subcultures. I guess the main question is this: is the sorting of people into self-chosen enclaves really a problem which needs to be solved? Or is it just a facet of human nature we should accept the way it is? Sowell discusses the movement which began in the 1950s, starting with the Supreme Court case Brown versus Board of Education, which ruled that racially segregated schools were inherently unequal and had to be abolished. This is an example of what Sowell would call third parties unsorting other people by force. Sowell gives the example of the all-black Dunbar High School, which before this decision had one of the best educational student outcomes in the city, better than most all-white high schools, which proved, according to Sowell, that racially segregated schools were not inherently inferior. But the court case led to the transformation of Dunbar from a high-performing all-black high school to a low-performing all-black high school. Sowell says this:
one of the painful ironies of the racial integration crusade was that Dunbar High School's 85 years of academic achievement came to an abrupt end in the wake of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. To comply with that decision, Washington schools were all made neighborhood schools, so that Dunbar could no longer admit black students from anywhere in the city, as it had before, but only students from the particular ghetto neighborhood where it was located. Dunbar quickly became a typical failing ghetto school with both academic and behavioral problems.
Sowell makes the argument that self-sorting within communities is an important adaptive feature of those communities. This is an important point which is crucial to understand. When people sort themselves into different groups, there is a concrete reason they are doing so, whether or not third parties understand or agree with those reasons. Let's hear Sowell explain how self-sorting created the 85-year track record of excellence at Dunbar High School.
Here, as with Dunbar High School during the past era of academic achievement, self-sorting was crucial. Black students were not simply assigned to go to Dunbar High School. They had to apply, and those with neither the interest nor the inclination to subject themselves to rigorous educational norms had no reason to apply. Internal differences have been at least as common among blacks as among other racial or ethnic groups, making self-sorting a way of reducing counterproductive frictions that impede education. Successful charter schools give a glimpse of what can be accomplished by Black children in low-income ghettos when self-sorting frees them from the disruptions and violence of unruly classmates, just a small number of whom can prevent a whole class from getting a decent education.
Sowell explains that the notion that the government needed to forcibly unsort people became a commonly accepted axiom in the mid-20th century and continues to this day, both in schools and in residential neighborhoods. According to Sowell, this has led to many negative effects and few positive ones.
In any event, the crusade to racially integrate public schools during the decades following the Brown v. Board of Education decision generated much social turmoil, racial polarization, and bitter backlashes, but no general educational improvement from seating Black school children next to white school children.
The idea of forcibly integrating schools ran parallel with the idea of forcibly integrating residential neighborhoods. Sowell says this:
the residential and other outcomes produced by the sorting of people became, in the second half of the 20th century, widely condemned as wrong in itself and as creating other social wrongs against the less fortunate groups. This might be considered a special case of the more general assumption that outcomes would tend to be even or random in the absence of malign intervention. But whatever it was based on, the view became axiomatic among many Americans in the second half of the 20th century that unsorting people was a high priority, especially in schools, but also in residential neighborhoods.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The healthiest food you can eat is the food you grow yourself. And on the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast, we tell you how to grow that healthy food as well as beautiful flowers. Plus, we tell you the things the nurseries don't want you to know.
There are no scientifically based studies that show that kelp meal or seaweed have any desirable effects on plants.
And we answer your garden questions. Well, at least we try to.
I have some nandinas that spread. How can I kill them?
You can't. Just move. That's the only way.
It's the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. It's out every Tuesday and Friday. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.
Sowell discusses the many government programs which financed moving low-income people from ghettos into middle-class neighborhoods and how those programs benefited neither the people who had been moved nor the people who lived in the neighborhoods into which they were moved. Sowell says this about the people being moved:
advocates of unsorting neighborhoods, whether by race or by class, argue that living in a better neighborhood will produce benefits for both the adults and the children who are moved in, and benefits of diversity for society at large. But these expected benefits to the newcomers from housing projects and high-crime neighborhoods have repeatedly failed to show up in extensive empirical studies by a wide variety of researchers on the federal government's Moving to Opportunity program.
And he says this about the people whose neighborhood hosted the newcomers:
more fundamentally, negative consequences to the pre-existing residents of the communities into which they have been placed are seldom, if ever, mentioned, much less measured, in these studies. It is as if any benefit, however small, to the new residents automatically outweighs any costs, however large, to the pre-existing residents.
I'd like to pause here to offer some personal reflections on Sowell's concept of sorting and unsorting people. Like so much that Sowell writes, he provides a new way of looking at social phenomena, a new framework to help understand what's really going on behind the curtain. So I started to think about all the many ways people sort themselves into groups. One of the most fundamental sorting categories humans have used historically is that of sex. Men sort themselves from women, and vice versa. There are men's restrooms and locker rooms separate from women's restrooms and locker rooms. Men play sports with other men, and women play sports with other women. There are all-girls schools. There are female-only fitness centers. There are men's fraternities at universities across the country, and there are women's sororities. It seems that men and women have been self-sorting themselves for millennia for a variety of reasons. What is interesting to notice is that recently the progressive movement has been testing the boundaries of this self-sorting by attempting to impose third-party governmental force to redraw the boundaries in different ways. I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that the very recent reimagining of personal pronouns, he, him, she, her, they, them, is, at its root, an attempt to fundamentally redesign the sorting of men and women. In addition, the movement to allow so-called trans people, i.e., people who identify as a gender which differs from their birth gender, to compete on sports teams of the opposite sex is a further blurring of the traditional ways of sorting men and women. And the whole concept of there being dozens of different genders, from cisgender to genderqueer to nonconforming to non-binary to intersex, please don't make me list them all, can really be seen as just another way to unsort the millennia-old fundamental sorting of men from women. Remember, these are my personal reflections, and this topic does not come from Sowell's book. I'm simply sharing with you some thoughts I have been having after reading his book. Another interesting sorting and unsorting phenomenon, which I have noticed, which happened just a few years ago, is the use of the term BIPOC, B-I-P-O-C, which stands for Black, Indigenous, People of Color. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, we had white kids, black kids, Chinese kids, Russian kids, Indian kids, Italian kids, Latino kids, Polish kids, Jewish kids, you name it. There were dozens of groups, and of course, we kids entertained playful stereotypes about the different groups. For example, that Chinese kids were supposedly good at math, and black kids were supposedly better at basketball. Whether true or not in most cases, all that was mostly a mental sorting device people used to help them make sense of the world as a sort of mental shortcut. And interestingly, the existence of so many categories of people distributed the group's rivalries widely and thinly. The groups generally got along and respected their differences. What I find interesting and dangerous about the rise of the term BIPOC is that it represents an unsorting of people from dozens of categories and a resorting into only two categories, white people and non-white people. If you buy into the concept of BIPOC, you have left a multipolar world and now mentally occupy a bipolar world. And long experience tells me that a bipolar world is much more contentious and dangerous than a multipolar world. The more I think about Sowell's concept of sorting and unsorting people, the more I see it as a powerful explanation for many things happening in the world around us. Here are some more examples. Number one. Exam schools like Stuyvesant High School in New York City. It used to be that the only way to get into Stuyvesant was by scoring above a certain level on a standardized test taken by over 30,000 students competing for only 850 spaces in the freshman class. This, in effect, was a powerful device for sorting students by IQ, with only the top 2.8% getting admitted. But because the school did not end up being as racially diverse as the larger population, third-party government officials decided to do away with this sorting device and install a new one in its place. Racial quotas using the disguise of neighborhood quotas. Affirmative action for particular groups, whether it be for Malays in Malaysia, or for so-called untouchables in India, or for blacks in the United States, has always been an unsorting mechanism used by third parties to resort people along racial and ideological lines. Speaking of India, the caste system is probably the best example of large-scale human sorting one can find. For thousands of years, people in India were sorted by birth into one of five castes or classes, which were lifelong designations one could not shed. Everything from the jobs one could do to the person one could marry were determined by the caste into which you were born. The Brahmins were at the top and the untouchables at the bottom of the social pecking order. Number two. The European Union and Brexit. Prior to 1993, when the EU was created, people were sorted into 27 distinct nations. The creation of the European Union was in effect an artificial unsorting of a centuries-old evolved sorting system, which included different languages, customs, and cultures. When Brexit happened in 2020, the British people had in effect decided to resort themselves out of the great unsorting which had occurred 17 years before. Number three. Russia and the Ukraine. The Ukraine sorted itself out from Russia in 1991, shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union. As I record this podcast, Putin is amassing troops on the border of the Ukraine with the intention of unsorting the Russian and Ukrainian peoples once again. Number four. Red states and blue states in the U.S. A recent sorting phenomenon occurring here in the U.S. is that of people moving from Democrat Party-dominated states to Republican Party-dominated states. Florida and Texas have become popular destinations for conservatives who view the Democratic Party's response to the coronavirus pandemic as beyond the pale. There are many, many examples of people voluntarily sorting themselves into groups, too many to name here. But let me finish this discussion by talking about what is perhaps the most dangerous and insidious form of sorting of all. And that is the sorting of people by knowledge that is occurring quietly in the background. Around 2016, the concept of fake news became prominent as people began accusing their intellectual opponents of propagating dangerous misinformation. Along with the rise of social media and sophisticated algorithms which determine what shows up on our screens, people began to sort themselves into knowledge bubbles, with different groups only seeing the information that social media companies choose to show them. Republicans might see a certain set of news stories, while Democrats might see a completely different set of stories. What most people don't realize is that fake news does not consist of stories you see which are not true, but rather, most fake news consists of the stories you don't see which are true. So people are living in parallel universes from each other, and the people you pass in the supermarket aisle may have a totally different view of reality from you. This is the ultimate sorting of people going on right before our eyes, and yet it's impossible to see this sorting with the naked eye. Only the mind can see it. Add to this phenomenon the intentional distortion of reality, which is being practiced by companies like Google, and you will understand how dangerous this phenomenon can be. Let me give you an example, and I really encourage you to try this out while you are listening. Bring a carrot with you, because what I am about to show you will take you deep down the rabbit hole. On your computer, go to Google Images by typing images.google.com into your browser. Now search for black couples and hit enter. What do you see? I see hundreds of photos of, well, black couples. So far, so good. Now type in white couples and what do you see? This time, they show you images of interracial couples, black couples, and some all-white couples. Quite a different spin, don't you think? Try the same thing using gay couples and straight couples and compare. It's the same distorted and manipulated search results. I'm not sure how the do-no-evil people at Google would try to contextualize this skewing of search results, but I think it's clear to everyone that they want you to see only what they want you to see. Sowell delves into many other topics in Chapter 3 of his book, Discrimination and Disparities. He talks about what I call the rub-off effect, which is how poorly behaving members of a particular racial group will reflect badly on better behaving members of that same group, because outsiders will not be able to easily tell the difference between them. In this chapter, he discusses how the mass migration of blacks from the South, who arrived in Chicago with very different social and behavioral standards from the blacks who had been born in Chicago, caused social problems for this latter group. He discusses the concept of disparate impact laws and how that has led businesses to locate their operations away from particular minority groups in order to avoid expensive lawsuits. These are fascinating topics in and of themselves, but I won't focus on them here. What I think is important to take away from Sowell in this chapter is that human beings intentionally sort themselves out from other human beings for a wide variety of adaptive reasons. We may know what those reasons are, or we may not. We may understand those reasons, or we may not. We may agree with those reasons, or we may not. The groups may be able to verbally articulate their reasons, or they may not. Now here's the key takeaway. When third parties attempt to sort or unsort other people along ideological lines, they run the risk of making things worse, regardless of how good their intentions might be from the outset. So why do third parties continue to meddle in other people's self-sorting? Let's end this summary with Sowell's explanation.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the All the Things podcast, and I'm your host, Sophia Merlo. Each week, you can expect tips and tricks from beauty to business experts or from myself as I navigate life as a young woman in her 20s. Every episode is chock full of value, tangible advice, while still sprinkling in relatable stories and keeping things real with my guests and you listening. Be sure to subscribe and tune in every Thursday so you don't miss an episode.
One major difference between people sorting or unsorting themselves, on the one hand, and government officials sorting or unsorting them, on the other hand, is that people who sort or unsort themselves receive both the benefits and the costs of doing so. But government officials receive neither the benefits nor the costs of unsorting other people, and so may persist in the process in utter disregard of benefits or costs that fall on others. Indeed, the political costs of admitting to having inflicted socially counterproductive policies are a powerful incentive to keep on inflicting those policies and ignoring or denying their consequences.
So that's my summary of Chapter 3. By the way, this is a great chapter to share with your friends if you'd like to introduce them to Sowell's way of thinking about social issues. He packs so much intellectual nutrition into so few calories of intake. I can't help but to think that anyone who reads this chapter will stop and say, "Whoa, who is this guy?" and want to read more. They'll be hooked, just like me and you. One of the great things about this podcast is that I get to talk with some excellent people about Sowell's ideas. Today, I get to talk about Chapter 3 with the one and only Charles Love. Charles is many things. He's a writer, a podcaster, a talk radio host, and also a doer. Charles has written 3 books so far. The first was Logic, The Truth About Blacks and the Republican Party. The second was We Want Equality, How the Fight for Equality Gave Way to Preference. And his latest book is called Race Crazy, BLM, 1619, and the Progressive Racism Movement. He is the host of The Charles Love Show and co-host of the Cut the Bull podcast with one of our past guests, Wilfred Riley. His radio show, The Charles Love Show, can be heard nationwide every Sunday on AM 560. He is a director of a nonprofit called Seeking Educational Excellence. Charles Love, Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I wanted to discuss with you Sowell's book, Discrimination and Disparities. It's only about 4 years old, so a lot of the examples in there are pretty recent, and it summarizes a lot of the ideas that he's had over the years. And had you read the book before I sent you this chapter? You had?
Yeah, I had, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, before we begin on that, let us know, what's your experience with Thomas Sowell? When did you first get introduced to him, and what have you read, and what are your thoughts about him?
I think he's, like most people, you know, I can't even say love him or hate him, because most people don't know him, and that's unfortunate. I think that he is a great voice of reason and logic, which is, I think most people who you see out there who make sense, who talk about these topics and they make sense, are borrowing from Sowell in some way. I can't say I've read the whole collection, probably about four of the books, Basic Economics, Black Rednecks and what is it? White, what is the other one? What does he call them? Black Rednecks and white?
White liberal. No.
Liberals, right?
Yeah, white liberals, yeah.
Yeah, so I've read that and this one, and I can't remember the last one. I think the next one I'm reading is his book on the charter school system. So I don't know, remember when I first got introduced to him, because my kind of foray into this thing is different from most people, because I'm not an academic. So I used to talk about things, and I think a lot of this stuff is just common sense. And I think that people approach things in a very emotional way, which is right, completely antithetical to Sowell, which is why some people, when they find him, they find so much reason in it. And also why when some people find him, they just like aghast at some of the things he says, right? It's like, how can you say that? And then you say, well, is it true? Well, yeah, it's true, but you can't say that, right? I think of, my friend, fellow scholar, 1776 Unites, Jason Hill. You should have him on. I don't know if you had or not, but I talked to him all the time. I was like, I don't even know if you could say, I wouldn't even say some of the things you're saying. He's like, well, is it true? I'm like, yeah, it's true, but you know, you can't say it. So you get a lot of that. And so like this chapter is a good example in that if you're being fair and you're not being emotional, you can't say that none of it's true. You can say, yes, these facts are true, but I come to a different conclusion than that. That's fine. But that's not what you hear about from people who attack Thomas Sowell and people like them. What they'll say is, the problem with you people is you think racism doesn't exist. Or you say that you think that there was never any government imposed unfairness or laws that hurt Blacks in the country. But if you read the book, the words are right there. It clearly says that, right? So what I take from it is what they really feel is that we downplay it in some ways. And that's true. I will admit that so, probably more so than me, but that a lot of us do downplay it. But if we want to be fair, we're downplaying it because we want to focus on something else. We think so. We're trying to say that's important. This is more important. But to be fair, they're emphasizing it more than they need to, right? So they're taking it and acting like it's the end all. You know, that's what I write about in my book. It's like, I'm not saying there's no racism, but you're saying if I look at a problem, the only solution is race. Racism is the only cause for that problem. So the only way to solve that problem is to fix racism. And I completely disagree with that. So that doesn't mean I don't believe that there was slavery or Jim Crow or that the current racist whites today. I just don't want to spend all my energy trying to fix racism. One, because I know I can't fix it. But two, it's because I know at the end of the day, when I fix it, which I can't, I already said that, but when I do fix it, find a way to fix it. They're going to be so crestfallen when they find out that there's still crime, disparity, as this chapter talks about, sorting and unsorting. All these things will still happen because those aren't race issues. Those are human nature issues.
Right. So let's talk about the sorting thing. You know, one of the things I like about this chapter is that it's called Sorting and Unsorting People. And I find that to be a very odd way to talk about people, because we don't usually refer, like, of all the things I do with other people, sorting and unsorting them is not something I usually think about. Right. But yet we do it all the time. We're always sorting people. There's men's rooms and there's women's rooms. Right. You know, a lot of times people say that Thomas Sowell is just common sense, which on one level is true. But on another level, he has some very paradoxical takes on things. So, for example, he talks about how immigrants have always sorted themselves into different neighborhoods. Mm-hmm.
So Italians will move into Italian neighborhoods. Jews will move into Jewish neighborhoods. And not only do they sort themselves in that way, but Italians from Sicily will go into Sicilian enclaves. Italians from Genoa will go into Genoan enclaves. Jews, Hungarian Jews will live together. Romanian Jews will separate themselves. German Jews will live in a totally different part of the city. You know, so you've got this happening with all different peoples. And what Sowell says is that we don't really notice it as much because they all kind of look alike. Whereas we notice when Blacks sort themselves away from whites, we see that with the naked eye, and we think it's a much more prevalent phenomenon between Blacks and whites than it is between other groups. But Sowell's saying it's not more prevalent. All groups do it, and they do it voluntarily, and they do it because they see benefits in doing it.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Prostate Cancer Real Talk is a video podcast that brings to life the true stories of prostate cancer. Early detection, treatment, prevention, symptoms, and even sexuality are all discussed like nowhere else. Professional guests include urologists, surgeons, sexual therapists, couples, and more who all share their experiences and perspectives. Ellen Shea are a real-life married couple who have faced it, fought it, and defeated it. Join Prostate Cancer Real Talk on Buzzsprout, YouTube, Spotify, Facebook, and other social media platforms.
Yeah, definitely. And I like the term, I mean, I agree with you. I think in the term of sorting, but I like the use of that term because it implies that not always, it's not like it is, like you say, their choice. They're doing it by choice. It's not the government forcing them to do it. But of course, there's exceptions, but I don't think in most cases it's like a very conscious thing. Like, obviously, it's not a subconscious thing, but it's not conscious to the point that they sit down at a table. It's like, we're going to America. Yeah, we're going to America. We're Italian. We should move to Italian, to find an Italian neighbor. Yeah, we should do that. But we should probably see if there's a block, search around and see if there's a block where it's mostly Sicilians. That would be even better. It's not conscious to that level, right? That's why I like sorting. It's just, you know, the way things flow. I mean, part of it's just maybe you know someone else. So you go where you already know somebody and the person you know just happens not to be a Hungarian Jew. But then it really, you know, like you talked about the paradoxical part of it, is you have to, because everybody, like you say, common sense, but they say soul is so stat driven. But the stats don't come to life if you can't tell good stories and explain it in a really interesting way. You know, one of the biggest things, I had Jason Reiling on, who wrote a book about him. We were talking about Maverick. And what I asked him was, did he agree in the sense that one of the things that made soul's work and approach to information so powerful is that he is obviously an academic, right? But he doesn't talk to people in a way that the regular guy would read his book and was like, I don't know what this guy's talking about. Can you explain it to me? You know, it's because he speaks in very simple terms and it's the way he explains it in these stories. So you go through, you know, different Jews from different places. You talk about Italians, but then he goes into an income thing. And that's one thing I talk about all the time. So I was born and raised in Gary, Indiana. And so we saw it, Gary's a unique city in the sense, I mean, big cities have neighborhoods, but very few cities were like Gary. The closest, I guess, would be Atlanta. And Gary's smaller now, but when I grew up, it was a city. It was almost 200,000 people. And upwards of 90% were Black, right? So I always tell people, I try to paint a picture so people would understand. They just don't get it. Like, you can't even say Atlanta and D.C., really, because D.C., you can go to K Street, right? You can go to areas where, you know, because the capital's there. You see affluent whites all over D.C. because of that, whether they come in from the D.C. area, come from Maryland or Virginia, but they're there. In Atlanta, there's Black white people in Atlanta. When I'm telling you about Gary in the 70s and 80s, outside of teachers and some workers who worked for the city who didn't do the white flight thing, everybody was Black, right? So it was completely contained, which means all the criminals were Black and all the successful people were Black. And that's what people have to, you have to close your eyes and think about that. So every drug dealer I saw was Black, but every lawyer, every cop, every police chief, the mayor, the city council, all those people were Black too, right? So it's a little bit different. And so I try to tell people, if you think about that, now go back during segregation when Blacks couldn't live wherever they wanted to live. And that's terrible, of course, because it's forced. However, And Sol touched on this with, from the economic standpoint when people move back, but I want to go a step before that. When Blacks had this, these all-Black communities, they were forced to live amongst each other regardless of income level. So your Black doctor lived next to your Black bus driver who lived next to your Black, you know, restaurant server or whatever it is. So you had every income living in a neighborhood. The moment the opportunities opened, who were the first people to move, right? So we look at it from like, we celebrated, obviously, because it had been so negative. We celebrate. Look at that Black guy buying that nice house in that nice neighborhood. Good for him. It makes me feel better. That's cool. But what they didn't realize is your neighborhood as a poor person or a working class person, you had access to cobblers and butchers and things of that nature because they were making their money off the people who had higher incomes. And then they were able to maintain the store, do whatever thing. And you had access to these things. Once they left, you weren't buying the hand-cut steaks. You weren't going to those places. You were just wearing your shoes when they were run down. You weren't getting them big. So then those businesses started to close, losing the tax base. This became a cycle. That wasn't really government driven. In a way, you could say them fixing the racism caused that. So you fast forward to this chapter, and Saul is saying, so they're in these neighborhoods, and then when poor Blacks would come into the neighborhood, they'd be like, whoa, 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 we don't want you here because you're going to bring down the quality of the neighborhood. We don't want that type here, right? So, and they got it from both sides. We know that your type doesn't live like us, and you haven't assimilated or whatever the case may be. So we're going to clash heads. But then the whites are going to see who live near us and saw us as, you know, palatable Blacks. And so, like, okay, that's not really that much of a difference. So now looking at us going to say, we can't tell the difference between you two. So it's easier for us to say, just distance ourselves from all of you than to try to pick which guy was already here or who, you know, has similar cultural norms as I do than those who bring all this negativity. And people with the emotional approach, we'll focus so much about whether that's fair or not, which is not, or whether they're right or not, of course not, because the percentages are low, and not focus on human nature. And I'm just saying, you know, I'm going to do what I think is easiest for me to put myself in the best position, and it may be lazy, but that's what I'm going to do. So this thing is a lot more complicated than people make it out to be, and he points that out really well by talking about that.
So you're getting at what I call the rub-off effect. So if there are members of your group who behave poorly and they look like you, the wider society holds it against you as well because they don't know how to distinguish you from the bad behavior people. We call that the
rebel. I give you an even better, you know, kind of smaller real life scenario. I was just talking to some friends at dinner the other day. So I grew up in a neighborhood that was working class and poor, but you know, everybody kind of did their thing. You had the normal, we had penny candy stores, we had all that kind of stuff. By the time I hit junior high school, that's when they started the whole one or two kids at a time can be in the store and the mirrors in the corner so you can watch the kids and, you know, doing all this stuff. And the first time somebody kind of, you know, what people hear it commonly now, they say, you know, the store owner will follow me around and will look and watch us and all that kind of stuff. And like anybody else, 12 to 15, I was like, man, I was like, that guy, you know, at first they were Black. But then when other store owners came in and they were other races, whatever, you'd be like, oh, they're racist. Why are they following us around? And I used to think like that, just like anybody else, but I've always been fairly logical. So then at the same time, I turned and I watched some of my classmates, not necessarily my closest friends, but people in the school, you know, sticking stuff in their bag, right? Sneaking out with stuff. So I'm like, should I be mad at this store owner, which is likely that, now it's not impossible, but it's highly unlikely that this man hates Black people so much that we moved all the way out here, drives all the way out here from the suburbs every day to sell stuff at the store, which obviously he could get more money somewhere else, or still lives in the community. Or is it the fact that he knows he has a serious shrinkage problem? All of the people, 100 of the people who are still, percent of the people who are stealing from him, are young Black males between, you know, 11 and 14. So what can he do? Now, this is the early 80s. It's not like he's got a sophisticated camera system. So he's like, what can I do to minimize that? So he discriminates against a young Black man. So I was mad, but I looked at it and I was like, I thought about it and I said, well, it's not really, it's partially his fault, but it's mostly the fault of these kids who were robbing him. Because if they weren't stealing from the store all the time, he wouldn't have to do it at all. Because it wasn't happening before that started to happen. It happened because as an effect, you know, a reply to what was going on. We have to do something. We're losing all this property. So an effect on a segment of the population. So if doing this thing has a disparate impact on Blacks, and you don't want that. You undo it. We can see that in a lot of things we do. Undoing it also has an effect, right? So at some point, we have to be adults and decide what is best for the most people that would have the least negative effect. So is it locking up, you know, or harassing, or you know, stopping and frisking or whatever, X number of more Blacks than you were doing before, and some people are going to get caught up and be completely innocent, and that's going to happen? Or do we do away with all that stuff? Do we not lock up any nonviolent offender? And then we have more people in our neighborhood being shot, right? Which is worse, right? And I'm not going to give you the answer. I'm going to tell the people, you need to decide that. The problem is the people you tell this to will say, it's not one or the other. I don't think letting people, nonviolent offenders out, causes more crime. So you're wrong there, you know? And then that's when you start going to the stats, and then, you know, that happens. But I think that you're right in a sense about your rub-off effect, but it's not always just coming from a standpoint of government programs or race or, you know, this. I mean, it applies to everything. So everything you do, it applies to. So I just think it's true, but I think it even has a wider effect than people really think about.
Sowell gives the example in the book of William Julius Wilson
getting in the elevator in his condominium. Do you remember that? So let me read that little passage for our listeners. Quote, I am an internationally known Harvard professor. This is William Julius Wilson speaking. Yet a number of unforgettable experiences remind me that as a Black male in America, looking considerably younger than my age, I am also feared. For example, several times over the years, I have stepped into the elevator of my condominium dressed in casual clothes, and could immediately tell from the body language of the other residents in the elevator that I made them feel uncomfortable. Were they thinking, what is this Black man doing in this expensive condominium? Are we in any danger? I once sarcastically said to a nervous elderly couple who hesitated to exit the elevator because we were all getting off on the same floor, not to worry, I am a Harvard professor and I have lived in this building for 9 years. When I am dressed casually, I am always a little relieved to step into an empty elevator, but I am not apprehensive if I am wearing a tie. I get angry each time I have an experience like the encounter in the elevator. So this was very similar to your candy store story, right? About being followed, right? Now, I think what Sowell says here is, here's the counterintuitive part. He says, and he compares Blacks from one era to another era. Unlike, this is Sowell, unlike Blacks from an earlier era who clearly blamed those Blacks whose behavior had brought on a retrogression that hurt all Blacks, Professor Wilson's account gives no indication of any sense that he was paying the social price for dangers created by Black hooligans and criminals. So that's where Sowell, he packs a punch. You know, he just knocks you in the jaw.
And see, that's where the people will come after Sowell and say, see, he's insensitive and he doesn't care. Because you know how they'll take it. It's like it doesn't matter what the words on the page say. What they heard is, you know, Blacks are hooligans, and that's why they're afraid. Good for Whitey. That's what they heard. Now, this is not me saying that's what he wrote. That's what they heard, right? And so that's what you have to contend with, which is why I knew, you know, kind of nuanced my approach a little bit more, but doesn't mean he's wrong. Because in that same conversation about the candy store, I gave him another example. So you got LA and New York, and you got Chicago. When I was coming up, you know, New York was getting better around the set at the time. It was a little bit better. But if you go back to when I was really young, like the 70s, all three of them had a bad crime problem. They all had a gang problem. By the time I was a child, L.A. and Chicago was still bad. New York was getting a little bit better, but you know, still had pockets. And so you got this crime and you got these gang members and, you know, police departments talk and they say, how can we fix this problem? And they say, we need to go after the gang heads because they're running things. So they did that. So now you fast forward to now, you wonder why everybody knows Chicago so much worse, and you wonder why. And I told them, like, this part had nothing to do with race. And so, you know, talk about this from a standpoint of how we got there, one, with good intentions, two, and at the end, I'm going to tie it into Willie and the Element. So, and Thomas Sowell and his hooligans. So what happened in Chicago, And I think all of them, they tried in LA too, but it, you know, they did a great job of it in Chicago. So Chicago had mainly three gangs, the Latin Kings, the GDs, and the Vice Lords, right? So if we go after the leads of these gangs, we could tear them down. We could tear up their operation. And they locked them up. They locked up Larry Hoover. They locked up all these people. But the gangs didn't go away. And they also, unlike the mob, they didn't just get a new head. That's not what happened. They crumbled into lesser groups, lots of small gangs, right? So whereas what happened, and it's just innate, right? Human nature. So what happened was, I'm a 13-year-old kid. I'm living in the gang life. And somebody does something to me at a club and I'm mad, I'm going to go out and shoot them, right? But the head of the gang was like, you're going to bring a problem on my business. Charles, shut up and sit down. And I answered to him because he was like, you know, the Don in a sense, right? When he said, jump, you jump. Now there's no leads. You just leaders. You just do whatever you want to do, right? So that was one problem. There was less control. But then it was fractured also. So now you had new gangs pop up, like hundreds of them. Chicago probably has more gangs than any city in the country. And they're block by block. Well, how do we educate our kids today, right? We go to neighborhood schools. So now you used to go to the GD school and everybody's school was either non-affiliated or they were in the same gang. So it was like, you know, it was a peaceful place for the most part. Now you have people from three gangs in the same school, right? So you bring in more animosity there. And the proof in the pudding, notice I didn't have to say race at all, is that New York and LA are combined 4.5 times the population of Chicago. And before the madness of King George Floyd, before that, 4.5 times the population, Chicago had double the murders. In its best year, it had slightly more murders than New York and LA combined, even though they had 4.5 times the number of people. It's not a race thing. The black people in all three cities, they're races in all three cities. They're run by similar politicians. They're all considered, you know, left leaning. I don't make it a political thing. It's not a political thing at all. It's not Democrats' fault at all. Set it on record. That's not it. Bottom line is all the cops are doing what they can to try to stop the crime, right? They fail in some instances. They succeed in some instances. But in Chicago, it was different. Why? The gang members weren't different. The police weren't different. It's because there was no head to go after. It was too many gangs in all the state. And to the Willie thing. So Chicago had this thing. They didn't have stop and frisk. But what they would do is they knew certain, it's what policing should be doing. They know certain neighborhoods are getting the most calls. They have the most gang and drug activity. So they, you know, circle that area. And they know most of the criminals fall in a certain criteria based on look and age and all that kind of stuff. So they profile. And so the kids get smart and they use it for their advantage. So what they do is they say, okay, most of us look alike. We're all around the same age, around the same height. So they became this de facto uniform. So they can get these, especially if you're poor, you don't want to look dirty, you can get these white t-shirts. They were dirt cheap, like 10 for like $4. So you buy a couple packs. So instead of washing your shirt, you would wash your shirt for 3 weeks, just put on a new shirt. So now you got a group of 8, 9, 10, 12 boys all standing in the corner with gym shoes, jeans, and a white t-shirt. Police pull out, they run. There was a shooting, let's say, or somebody got robbed and they're looking for a guy. How do they know which guy it was? They're all black. They're all wearing the same clothes and they're all running in different directions. Go after the 13-year-old black kid with the white t-shirt. Which one? Right? So in their respect, it was easier for them, right? They did it because it was easier for them to blend in. The police made it harder for the police to harass them. So they kind of one up the police officers. Then, you know, entertainment to finish it off, entertainment and real life, they all kind of mimic and copy each other, right? So then rappers started to wear it in a video. Then the other kids who weren't in gangs would see it and be like, well, hey, if this rapper's winning, I'm dressed like that. So now you get all the kids who aren't gang affiliated dressed the same way. How can you tell them apart? Now they're all the stereotype of Willie and no one's wearing the tie. So if society thinks, well, and then you put it out there that the gang members are wearing this and all these people are wearing it, then all of them are gang members. It's unfair, but that's what happened. So now no one's telling, can tell them apart, and chaos ensued.
Wow. I just learned a ton about the whole mentality there. That's incredible. In a way, they were engaged.
Without mentioning race, though, right? I never said, you know, this politician. I never said Donald Trump or Biden. I never said black people or the white man did this or the government did this. It just happened, right? The government did what they were supposed to do. There was a crime problem. They went to the head of that crime and they arrested them. Problem solved or not.
In a way, what these guys were doing was they were sort of unsorting themselves with the clothing.
Oh, no, resorting.
Resorting, like a different. Now, let me ask, while we're talking about clothing, first of all, what year were you born?
I was born in 1971.
Okay. Okay, because the way you were talking about it, it sounded like we went to school around the same time. I went to high school in 76.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to high school what, like?
In 85.
Okay, so about 10 years behind me. So when I went to Forest Hills High School in Queens, New York.
Okay.
Do you know the area at all?
Not much. Okay.
This was, I think, around the time when busing was popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember the school had a very large contingent of Black kids who were coming from Jamaica, Queens, mm-hmm. which was at the time a Black neighborhood, if I remember correctly. And this was when busing was considered the solution. Sobel talks about this in the chapter, you know, which is basically the unsorting, the third party government unsorting the neighborhoods and the schools by forcing people to go to different schools and different neighborhoods. And I remember it was very unproblematic. I don't remember any problems because of it, but I just wanted to sort of date myself as being, I remember that as a teenager. Another thing I remember was going to university. And this I really want to get your comment on, because this was a real shocking experience to me. I arrived on my first day at the University of Pennsylvania. I was a freshman. It was 1980. And I'm walking along the campus and I see a building, and it was a lot of Black people standing around in front of the building. And I said to a friend, "What is that building?" And they said, "That's the W.E.B. Du Bois House." I'm like, "What is that?" And they say, "Well, that's a dormitory only for Blacks." And I said, "You got to be kidding me. People are choosing to go into a dormitory with only one type of person at a university in the year 1980. I actually couldn't believe it, because I thought in my naivete that one of the reasons we go to college was to mix with people who are different from us and to learn from other people. And here I was seeing people voluntarily sorting themselves into single race dormitories. What do you think about that?
Well, it's interesting. It made me think of two things. One, I'll wait till later because I'm sure it's going to come up, and that's a biggie. But one, it doesn't surprise me. And I think that the reason why it surprised you is a positive thing. It's a New York thing, right? Because you look at going back to Chicago in that area, Chicago today, I mean, you're talking about, you know, the 80s, 40 years ago. Today is probably the most segregated city in the country, right? People talk about that mostly in negative terms and all that stuff. This is funny. We're talking about this chapter because this is one of the things I say a lot amongst my friends, but I don't say it on interviews because it's not come up. This is a specific topic. Thomas Sowell hit the nail on the head in this respect. We're ignoring the voluntary sorting in a sense. So Chicago's the most segregated big city in the country. Nobody would dispute that. But most of the people, especially if they're progressive, would tell you it's because of all these systems in the past that were racist. Which part of it is how we got the neighborhoods got there, definitely how they got bad. All that part's true. What they don't tell you, because that's the thing, problem with most of the things we're trying to solve is no one wants to talk about the whole story, is the self-segregation of Chicago. I both on both ends. So quickly, both ends. So I know poor people who are on government assistance destination. Chicago, you can get a voucher, right? To get that voucher, let's say the average rent in Chicago is $1,800. And you, based on your income, you get $1,200. Here's $1,200 to subsidize. Go live wherever you want, right? So the people who don't live in the neighborhood and don't experience, go through the system, don't experience it, understand it, think that the government's pushing people into Austin and Inglewood or whatever the case may be. Live wherever you want. I have a friend who's not on Section 8 now, but when she was, you know, she got that voucher. She's like, well, I'm going to go up to Rogers Park. Rogers Park's a little different now that she's older. So this was 30 years ago. And they were like, and her friends were like, don't go up there. The white people are up there. She's like, yeah, but I mean, I'm tired of this and the crime or whatever. I'm going to go there, but you can't go there. And they were like, oh my gosh, she's going to be killed. And she's like, I'm going to try it anyway. But you talk to her and she'll tell you, but I was kind of afraid because they had that in my head. I was afraid to go up there because it's white people. And she went up there and moved on, had a good time up there, whatever. So people do that. They just stay where they are. And in Chicago, they got rid of it because people complained. But for a while, they had this thing called the super voucher, right? So it's funny. Thomas Sowell talked about this in a chapter too. This chapter is like a book. You're right. I give you credit for picking it. But what the super voucher was, it was a belief that people sat back and said, okay, we have to help these people. So we gave them a voucher. But we need to help them more. We think that if we put them amongst middle-class people, we can change their mentality. And we can talk about my views on that. And so they said, okay. So instead of giving the, in my example, I forgot the exact number. So in my example, I said $1,200 is the normal voucher. We're going to give them a $3,000 voucher, right? But it'd be like a lottery. So, you know, you got to win it. Well, you get the $3,000. Now you can go live at the Lake Point Towers, or you can live in River North, or you can live downtown, or you can live wherever, right? So that was supposed to change their experience and change their lives by changing the environment of the people that you're with. But the chances are, you know, none of this stuff is actually done without people knowing about it. So it's kind of like sending a poor kid to an elite school that doesn't have the elite grades and is struggling to keep up. If you can keep up, it's fine. But even then, you still feel left out because you're like, well, I'm not really like them. I'm here. I'm going to the same classes. But when I walk out of school, I'm going to the bus, to the train, to the bus. And that guy, my classmate, is getting in his BMW. You think they don't see that, right? On both sides, right? So, you know, that was that factor. So that's one. So some people would not even try to get the super voucher. But then I know a lot of upper middle class Blacks went to the top schools, who had good jobs, was like, yeah, I want to live in Bronzeville. I want to live in the Black neighborhoods. But they complain about the lack of resources there, but they don't want to live in a white neighborhood. So that's where they want to live. So they move there, right? So there's nothing wrong with living there. Of course not. But they're still self-segregated. They're saying, I make $200,000 a year. I can live anywhere in the city I want to live. And that's where I want to live. The place with the supposed quote unquote food desert, where it takes longer to get there and the cabs don't want to go. Why would you do that to yourself? Because it's that important to me to live amongst Black people.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. My name is Catalina. I'm a 2-time cancer survivor and a babe with a mobility aid.
My name is Haley. I'm a PA with POTS and a water allergy. We are the hosts of the Doing It Disabled podcast.
Haley and I are on a mission to create an honest dialogue about living with disability and chronic illness. We would like to open up our corner of the internet to both learn and teach about the lived experiences of the disabled community.
Join us as we navigate this world that was not created with us in mind and watch how we do it disabled. Head on over to Spotify and check us out.
So, you know, I mean, I think the bottom line on this whole sorting and unsorting conversation is that people voluntarily do it a lot of the time, and they do it for specific reasons. And should government, should third parties try to unsort them? And should they try to unsort the schools? Should they try to unsort the neighborhoods? And Sowell is basically saying no. Am I reading this right? He's basically saying that there's no evidence that forced unsorting helps anybody, but there is a lot of evidence that it hurts some people. That's basically what Sowell is saying. Am I right about that? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I believe so. And the problem is that if you have to look at why they're sorting, if the sorting is because of government and racism, then unsorting is fine, right? Because you're forcing me to not be able, I want to live in that neighborhood, and you're telling me because of my skin color I can't live in that neighborhood. So stopping that is fine. But what you end up going too far, getting to the point that I'm comfortable living in an Italian neighborhood. So forcing Blacks into my neighborhood is a problem because I'm comfortable and they're comfortable. Now we're both uncomfortable for the good of the cause, right? Or, I mean, what are you helping? And then the school thing is really important because he makes a great point of pointing out how, because some predominantly Black schools are failing, they obviously erroneously felt that the thing that made this, it's shocking to me that progressives don't see that this is racist. They think that the thing that made that school fail was the Blackness. So you're basically saying whites are better, because you're saying if we added some whites to that school, or if we took the Blacks and put them in a white school, then they would be better because, you know, white students are just better. And he didn't talk about it much, but it's a really big thing in the Black community. Less so now because younger people didn't pass it on to the younger people and are confused. But if you talk to people 50 and older, they'll tell you that, you know, the quiet secret of the Black community is everybody talks about Martin Luther King because, you know, he pushed for equality, which was great. But most Black people, and there was a rift in the movement, and most Black people had no problem with separate but equal, right? In its theory, they had a problem with the application. The problem was that it was not equal, right? They weren't equal in volume, equal in selection, equal in quality. But if you ask the average Black person from 1960 to 1975, if we split it up, right? equal number of hotels, stores, restaurants, gas stations, blah, 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 store, car dealerships, all that kind of stuff. And San Juan, they get Mercedes, we get BMW, right? They get the Mandarin Oriental, we get the Four Seasons, right? So quality was equal, and you can go to every city and find it. Now, that's your option or integration. Which one you pick? I would say 84% of Blacks would pick that. They would not pick integration. They had no problem with not living amongst whites. They had a problem with, if I want a nice meal, I got to go to a white community. And then the white community is telling me I can't come. Right? So yeah, I want to go because I want prime rib and that's where they sell it. But if I get prime quality prime rib in my block, I don't want to go over there. Right? And you can't say that today because they're like, yeah, you know, that's just not cool. It's not equity. It's not diversity. It's not inclusion, whatever. But most people don't really want that. Right? I want to be friendly with other people when I'm around them, and I don't want anybody attacking anybody, but I want to be free to go wherever I want to go. I want to be free to sort, as the chapter says.
Right.
So when you force that, of course that's a problem, but really quickly to the education, because it's so important. Acting like Black, it's in itself is bad. He talked about Dunbar, but you know, again, you forget, my town was all Black. So we had multiple elementary schools. And like I don't know, because it was a bigger city. They ended up closing some. When I was a kid, I don't know, 60 maybe. And then we had about seven middle schools and six high schools when I was growing up. The high school I went to, every high school had an elementary school close to it, and then there were others. So the elementary school I went to was an excellent elementary school. Not, you know, I'm too young to know why, but it pumped. It was Dunbar of Gary, right? It pumped out. Put it this way, six high schools. The year I graduated, every valedictorian in the city went to elementary school with me. Every single one of them. Half the honor students at my high school, right? So we would do these competitions, all Black. And we would do the competitions with all the citywide. And in the winters, we would do these academic math and science competitions across the county. And we placed in the top three nearly every year in math. Every student in my class. I mean, I went to school with one white kid in my grade. There were a couple others in my grade with one, and she dropped out my freshman year. So I never went to school in my class, graduating class with a white kid. But we competed academically. But according to the unsorters, that's an anomaly because Blacks aren't smart enough. You need to throw some white kids in there to raise up the quality of the education. No, we just need quality education. But you need to get another type of sorting. What you need to be able to do is to sort out bad students. Are the ones, because so if I'm teaching at this level and you're learning at this level, if I can't get you up to this level in 1 year, you need to go to a different school. I'm not putting you down. I'm not saying you're beneath, but you're going to bring down. This is now an excellent school. So if your grades don't meet here, you go to another school. It's average school. You still go to college and do well, but you can't. We're pumping an elite school here and we don't care what skin color you are. We care what grades you get and if you can keep up, but they don't do that, right? So that's what hurts them. It's not sending them to white schools or bringing in white school. When you say stuff like that, it's racist. We don't know what these Black kids need in order to get into college and to do well and to be successful is to go to school with white kids. Right. And that's what he points out in the book. But that's really important. I mean, I've seen it firsthand. It doesn't make sense. But that's what we're doing. And I think they're helping. And it's not. And it's racist. They're saying basically Blacks, in order for Blacks to succeed, they need something from the whites who are racist.
Right. So we'll talks about Dunbar. I mean, I think he talks about that in so many different books. You know, I've been hearing the name Dunbar, Dunbar, Dunbar ever since I've been reading Sowell. And
yeah, look at what they did, though. Look at what they pumped out, right?
Well, Sowell's making the argument that Brown versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court was actually had a lot of negative effects.
No, but what I'm saying is it's common in the Black community to say that. They just don't think about it. They don't tie it to the other piece. But I hear it all the time amongst my friends. Like, man, I mean, it's like an inside Black joke that integration hurt us. Like, we should just stay for our own. And they'll say things like, I'm more Malcolm than Martin.
Right.
Right. They're like, we should have been doing this as opposed to expecting them to do this. Right. They say it a little more, you know, aggressively toward government than that. But basically, that's what they're saying. Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, a lot of people I know kind of think that way, thinks that. Another side effect, you talk about your rub-off effect. So you got these Black schools. You got a Dunbar. He talked about what happened at Dunbar, but not only because of what happened. He talked about it because of the neighborhood became this and you couldn't pick people from all over the city. And he's right about that. But there's another factor, real common sense factor. If I have, Gary, if I have seven schools in an all-Black neighborhood with all-Black students and they all have Black teachers, and we go back to you a little bit before you, back when they started the bus, right? we're going to bus kids, right? Bus kids out to from Gary to, you know, Cherville, Maryville, whatever. What happens to the Black teachers? Because you're not busing them to Cherville. Cherville already has teachers. To Maryville, they already have teachers. So now we're back 40 years later to the whole, well, we need culturally relevant teaching because Black kids learn best if they have Black teachers. They need to see role models. Well, they have Black teachers. Your government took them. Because if I'm a Black teacher in a school with 40 other Black teachers, and all my kids go to another school, that school stays open, but it's half the size, so you don't need as many teachers. Where do these other teachers go? That school's not hiring them, maybe one or two. So now you just displace thousands of teachers over years and limited the input of Black college-educated people who wanted to be teachers because they don't want to be teachers anymore, right? So they go off into other fields. So you've watered down the pool of educated Blacks who could have taught them on the one end, in addition to the other piece, and no one talks about that piece.
Let me ask you this question. One of the things that Sowell talks about in this chapter is people sort themselves by the way they marry.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I find this to be an extremely fascinating subject and one that almost no one ever really talks about. You know, you hear a lot of talk these days about racism and anti-racism, but I never hear anybody mentioning intermarriage as a tool of anti-racism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never hear the progressives, you know, the Kendis and the DeAngelos talk about maybe we should promote intermarriage as a way of gradually mixing things up so that it becomes almost impossible to be racist.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
FedBiz 5.
We get it. You're busy. That's why the FedBiz 5 podcast covers government contracting related topics in just 5 minutes. Whether you're an established federal contractor or aspire to sell to the federal government, the hard-hitting weekly FedBiz 5 podcast will teach you strategies and provide insights from industry experts that will help simplify government contracting, providing you with a clear path from registration to award. So take a listen to FedBiz 5 today, where you get informed, get connected, and get results on everything government contracting.
You never hear that.
Well, let's be fair. You don't hear that DeAngelo's and Kendi's are most progressive promoting marriage at all.
That's true. That's true.
Right? They're like, marriage? Who needs a dad? That sucks. Right? What is, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. What are you talking about? Right. I mean, and so I think that's the problem. I mean, I think that is definitely interesting, but I think we jumped that whole, I mean, that conversation. And like you said, the book's not even that old, but we moved to the left and warp speed now, that's an obsolete argument, right? Because nobody even, I mean, we're talking about, we got a major group like sucking in money with a vacuum cleaner talking about we want to end this cis-hetero patriarchy and the traditional family. Ooh, nuclear family's bad. So we can't even talk about intermarrying. They're like, oh, why do we need to marry? Why do people need two parents? That's so white man running the country. That's so white Jesus. Nobody needs that stuff.
Even if you don't believe in marriage, I mean, I think it's hard to find people who think that the human race should stop procreating. So I don't know.
Some of them are saying, come on now. Some of them are saying, don't have kids. The environmentalists are saying, well, if we just have fewer kids, right? You've seen the articles in the New York and all the progressive magazines saying, you know, interviewing some really emotional woman saying, the reason I decided to not have children to save the world.
Even people who believe that we should be having fewer children still believe that we should be having some. So yeah. at the very least, you would think they would be advocating for all of the ones that we do have, however few they may be, to be racially mixed. Because
right.
to me, that would be like an obvious solution.
Right, but you're right. Problem. Now, if we're going to talk about that, they don't want to, though, because it's almost like it's all, that's the most, one of the most frustrating things about this. It's like, if you could sit one of them down, you're like, dude, like no cameras, or just you and them talking, like, dude, you know what you're saying is crazy. It's like, yeah, but, you know, I got this goal I'm fighting for. Whatever I got to do, but between me and you, I mean, like, you talk about racism and how we need to help the Black man. Let's say we're talking to a white liberal woman. You ain't marrying no Black man. Right. You're not doing it. You're not. I'm not saying it's not going up. It's not like there all these. It should be whatever the percentage is in the country now. I don't know what it is. You know, they say it's going up in some areas as high as 10%, whatever, 15%. But that's across all things. So they count, you know, Black people who marry other minorities too. But still, whatever it is. In this uber progressive circles, it should be, you know, forget about the suggesting that other people intermarry. They should be in the 80-90 percentile, right? But most of them are either single, told you, or they're married to other Jews. They're married to other Italians. They're married to other, you know, whatever. Now the only time you see it is in lesbian and gay communities, right? So if you're the lesbian woman will be in a relationship with a lesbian woman from another race. But if you're talking about straight women, straight men, they're marrying white, Jewish, Italian, the whole nine. They're writing all day about the terrible whatever. And the funniest thing is they're writing that whites in general are racist, D'Angelo. And then they're marrying whites. It's fascinating. Now, to the credit, at least the Black liberals do. Most of the Black liberals are in interracial relationships. But that's even funny because it's as they say, whitey's bad, you know, Don Lemon, we can go down the list, Jordan Peele. It's so many of them. They're all like, whitey's bad. But, you know, my wife, my husband's white, not him, not her, just all the other whites. Right. But for the white liberal, no. We want to talk the talk. And then with communities, the same. Right. We need to help those Black and brown communities. And then I go to the most expensive, most white zip code I can find when I go shopping for a house.
Has there been a better movie about the subject of race than Crash?
You know, I mean, it's funny. I liked it. And I love the point that they were trying to make. You couldn't make it today because they have to sprinkle in some wokeness. But I like the nuance and what they were trying to point out. And it was a little cheesy at times tying it together. But I mean, I do like, you know, how everybody was being unfairly stereotyped, but we're also unfairly stereotyping, right? Like the Middle Eastern guy who got robbed, and when the guy came to fix his locks, he's like, "Oh, what are you doing here?" Right? Because he was Hispanic, right? Yeah, it was basically they were trying to make a point, somewhat heavy-handedly, but I think they did it. They're like, you can't just assume that these people are, you know, whatever you believe of that group.
So would it be accurate to say that you think that a society is race crazy?
What a segue. It definitely is. Well, it definitely is. But really quick, I say that because it's really, you know, at first I was like bristled. I'm like, man, because I couldn't think of a title. My publisher said, how about this? I'm like, I don't know. People are going to think it's really political and it's not. And people are going to be mad. I said, but technically it's true. So I had to channel Thomas Sowell and say, if it's true, go with it. But I say it's race crazy mostly because what I'm saying is there's a solution. There's too much crime in community X, right? If it weren't crime and it weren't race, if it was just a, you know, innocuous problem we're trying to solve in a boardroom at a company, we're having a problem with one of our products, it's defective. We would get in the boardroom with people from marketing, from engineering, we would get on the whiteboard, we write all the possible problems, and we split up in the team to say, you check this and see if it's the raw material. You check and see if there's something on the assembly line. You check and see if it's communication, right? We figure out what the problem is. But today, since we're race crazy, what we do is we get in the boardroom with all these people around, we put racism, then we put the chalk down and we're done. I said, chalk, how old am I? Whiteboard. We put the marker down and we're like, we're done. That's the problem. So we fix this, then we can solve everything. And it's silly. You can't. So all I'm saying is when you're race crazy, you have blinders on. So you won't even be willing to put other things. I'm not even saying don't put race on the board. Not saying that. But can we put something else on the board? Can we put, you know, whatever the case, depending on what problem we're trying to solve. We're trying to solve education gaps. Can we put testing? Can we put home life? Can we put the actual acumen? Can we put how we teach them to read? Can we put the number of books in the young? Because if it's not enough access to reading at 5, then we say, if that's the solution, we can't force the parents to do it. But then we find mentors. We bring in an army of people. We do, you know, engineers read. We create these organizations where we read to kids, right? And all that stuff. And we incentivize. We pay the parents to bring them. We can do stuff like that if we say that's the problem. If we say the way we're teaching this problem in the curriculum, we can change the curriculum. But we say the problem is race. We just start moving people around by skin color. And then we find out, man, it didn't fix it. Oh, we didn't move them enough. So we're not even focused on the solution. Crime. Do we figure out why people are willing to rob a liquor store? Or do we just say the system is bad? They're locking up too many black people, so we need to let more black people out of jail. That's why I say the society is now race crazy, because everything must, our president said it. He was 6 days on the job. I will view everything, and I challenge and I call on every department to view race as an important issue in everything they do. So I want my military looking at race. I want the Department of Ed looking at race. I want transportation looking at race. How are you going to fix anything that way? Because what you're closing your mind to the possibility that it could be something else. It might be race, and then you're doing a good job. But if it happens not to be race, you're screwed because you didn't even put anything else on the board.
Where do you think Thomas Sowell fits in on this? I mean, you know, one of the reasons I started this podcast was because I felt like the world would just be a better place if more people knew about him, read his ideas, talked about his ideas. But it just feels like we're barely even scratching the surface. You know, the vast majority of, I went onto Caltech campus in one of my episodes and I interviewed the first 20 people. Not a single person had ever heard the name Thomas Sowell before. And these are the most highly educated people in the country. So it feels like, you know, we're really facing a tsunami of ignorance about his ideas and ideas like his.
Yeah, and it's even worse because of what he's accomplished. You know, in a country, that's why I say it's all fake, right? It's all about, they use a veneer of race and gender, all this stuff, but it's really about what we like the most and what we care. Because here's a man, when you want to celebrate people, here's a man who grew up poor, who struggled academically for a while, right? Had somebody who saw something in him, made it to a level but that he was okay, but he still could have stopped there. But then he went further. But the key is, he didn't really become the Thomas Sowell, you know, centrist and conservative, know and love, till he was like 40 something, right? So he said, so then that adds another element of mystique. So at 44, people are like, hey, there's this guy. So now he's going on the shows and he's speaking, he's writing books, he started writing books. And now he's like writing a book every year for a period. Just every year, here's another book, right? So he's out there, he's teaching, whatever. And then he had to get to the crossroads. It's like, how can I reach the most people? And decided that teaching wasn't it, right? So he left to go so he can focus on writing. Then he wrote a column on a regular basis that he didn't end until he was, how old was he, 86 when he ended his column, something like that? And that is still with us, right? And so, if for nothing else, because of what he's accomplished in an era that we're all race crazy, shouldn't we be propping him up for that alone? But no, like you said, he is a virtual, and he's an academic. I can get you not knowing me, right? But he's an academic. So for all those elite circles where they talk about all these elites, they don't even talk about him. It might be better if they dismissed him, if they talked about him and said, listen to this kook, right? Right. At least you're arguing his point. They just act as if he doesn't exist. And that's the reason why you can go on a campus. You can go to an elite campus. You can probably go to, maybe not University of Chicago, but you could probably go to some very elite colleges and people will be like, I don't know who that dude is. No idea. And it's unfortunate.
I should do the survey on Stanford's campus, which is where he works.
Right.
That's really interesting.
And University of Chicago, right? And say, I think they'll know him on those two campuses, though. Not MIT and Harvard and all those schools. They probably wouldn't know him. NYU. Nope.
You know I'm going to Stanford, right? I mean, now it's my mission.
I'm doing it now.
I've got to do it.
I want to hear what the results are. I'm going to guess that minimum 30% will know. This is still too low, but it's not what you're going to get when you go to, you know, the Seven Sisters or something.
Right. I know we're at the end of our time. Charles Love, thank you for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
I'd like to end this episode with a clip from the 2004 movie Crash, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture that year. This clip touches on the subjects of race, discrimination, stereotyping, and the rub-off effect we discussed in the podcast. Close your eyes, imagine the scene, and get ready to smile, and ask yourself if a movie like Crash could get made today.
Did you see any white people in there waiting an hour and 32 minutes for a plate of spaghetti? Huh? And how many cups of coffee did we get?
You don't drink coffee, and I didn't want any.
Man, that woman in there poured cup after cup to every single white person around us. But did she even ask you if you wanted any?
We didn't get any coffee that you didn't want and I didn't order. And that's evidence of racial discrimination. Did you notice that our waitress was black?
And black women don't think in stereotypes? You tell me something, man. When was the last time you met one who didn't think she knew everything about your little lazy ass before you even opened your mouth? Huh? That waitress sized us up in 2 seconds. We're black and black people don't tip. So she wasn't gonna waste her time? Now, somebody like that, nothing you could do to change their mind.
So, how much is you leaving?
You expect me to pay for that kind of service? What? What the fuck is you laughing at, man?
I'm seriously starting to think that you're jealous of Karen.
Hardly. I'd just like to see you get through a meal without calling her or anyone else for that matter.
Okay, look, no more phone calls tonight. As a matter of fact, here, you can hold the battery. Okay?
$10 says she calls you in the car.
Wait. You see what that woman just did? You see that?
Why, she's cold.
She got colder as soon as she saw us, though.
Oh, man, come on, don't stop.
Man, look around you, man. You couldn't find a whiter, safer, or better lit part of this city right now. But yet this white woman sees two black guys who look like UCLA students strolling down the sidewalk, and her reaction is blind fear? I mean, look at us, dog. Are we dressed like gangbangers? Huh? No. Do we look threatening? No. Fact, if anybody should be scared around here, it's us. We're the only two black faces surrounded by a sea of over-caffeinated white people patrolled by the trigger-happy LAPD. So you tell me, why aren't we scared?
Because we got guns?
You could be right.
Get the fuck out of the car!
Give me the keys!
Come on,
okay,
hurry
okay,
up!
Okay.
Get down!
No, please.
Don't look at me. Motherfucker, I said don't look at me. Turn around. Come on, go.
I'm Alan Woolen, and this has been episode 11 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Thanks for listening.